live from the 860 AM studios in Philadelphia. This is Unexpected Goals. I'm Rich.
And I'm Rusty.
And welcome to the show. We have a lot to talk about today, Rust. We have Virgil van Dijk's season-ending injury and what that might mean for the Premier League and the Champions League. We have traffic jams atop the major leagues in Europe, including the Bundesliga and Ligue 1, which is a surprise. Rejection of Project Big Picture by basically everybody except those who proposed it, which means there is a stalemate right now among European soccer powers as to what to do next. Some early redemption for Unai Emery, perhaps, and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And as a reminder, we are on social media, so check us out on Twitter at UnexGoals. That's UnEx as in EX Goals. And on Facebook, just look for Unexpected Goals. And follow our personal accounts too, at Rusty underscore Gorlick and at Gorlick Rich. So we're happy to be on the air. We have the wonderful Sean Spence behind the glass. And Rusty, as always, we have some soccer birthdays today, so why don't you share them with us?
Yeah, I mean, we've had some better days for soccer birthdays, but we've certainly had worse days for soccer birthdays. So it's a pretty good day if you're a Liverpool fanatic. The former Liverpool striker Ian Rush, who scored a franchise record 346 goals with the club in the 1980s and 90s, and who was the PFA Players Player of the Year in 1984 and won Europe's Golden Boot in 1984, turns 59 today. Dutch and former Spurs goalkeeper Michel Vorm is 37. And Lyon fullback Mattia De Ciglio, on loan from Juventus, is 28. So let's get straight into the big topic of the weekend. The big story comes from Merseyside derby between Everton and Liverpool, mentioned a little bit earlier. Everton goalie Jordan Pickford, who as of this very moment is England's number one keeper, we'll see how long that lasts, he smashed into the world's best defender, Virgil van Dijk, forcing him out of the game and tearing his ACL, putting him out for the season. No cards were issued for a foul that, to me, looked a little bit like an NFL chop block. So, Rich, should that have been a straight red card, an automatic three-match ban for Jordan Pickford?
Yes, I think it was. Straight red card, absolutely. And it's hard to get a straight answer as to whether the VAR official reviewed the challenge or not. And if he did, he did not determine that the referee's decision was a clear and obvious error that warranted overturning an issuance of a straight red card. And if it was the latter, at least why did he not call the official over to review the challenge himself? Shameful, really. And the argument that an offsite call would negate any call on action that took place afterwards is just absolutely absurd, Rusty. I mean, if there's a dead ball and a player were to whack another player, say on the head, a red card would come out and the player would be sent off. We've seen managers get red cards while the play is dead. There is absolutely no difference here. It was a straight red card. Should have been that. Pickford should have been ejected. Totally reckless challenge. I didn't think he wanted to hurt Van Dijk. He's just a very aggressive keeper who doesn't know his limits. It should have been penalized. End of story. And just a miss by the officials that populate, sadly, the English Premier League for the most part.
Yeah, I agree with you. From a referee's perspective, I could see how they don't like to give or call fouls against goalkeepers in their own box, but this was pretty egregious in my opinion. But back in 2017, when Virgil van Dijk joined Liverpool, they improved drastically and immediately. So what do you think his injury means for Liverpool and the races for the Premier League and the Champions League?
Wow, not good. Not good at all. I think it would look like Liverpool will have to start Joel Matip, the Cameroonian, and Joe Gomez at least through January. Joe Gomez was a bit out of form. They don't really have any backups for them, and they have an ambitious schedule, so they might have to drop Fabinho back to play center back, which now they have more opportunity to do because they have Thiago Alcantara to play holding midfielder, where he gives them a lot of options. Nathaniel Phillips, who's made one appearance with the first team, and the youngster Sepp Vandenberg, who really needs to go out on loan somewhere. I mean, to thrust him into this would be unfair. And not only are they thin, but Alisson, their goalkeeper, is out with an injury for about five more weeks, and the iffy Adrian is now in goal. So my guess is that Jurgen Klopp and Michael Edwards will be putting their heads together. Michael Edwards is their salary cap or spending valuations guru, a combination of a cap master in the NFL, although there is no cap in the Premier League, and also just a Moneyball type of guy. And they're going to put their heads together to look for a replacement in the January transfer window, especially, Rusty, if it looks like Liverpool will survive a very tough group stage in the Champions League that has them paired with an Atalanta team with a very leaky defense and an Ajax team that's always tough, and then Mkhitaryan from Denmark.
I think Denmark.
They're a good team for Denmark, but I don't think should be much of a challenge. But center backs are...
They're owned by the same guy who owns Brentford, fun fact.
Ah, okay. So he must be at least doing some cartwheels somewhere, that gentleman. But Russ, center backs are at premium, right? They just are. I mean, over the past, 5 years, Manchester City has spent £500 million, which is about $675 million just on center backs. It's like that movie Searching for the Next Bobby Fischer, the great chess champion who turned out to be insane, we think, is looking for that great next Vincent Kompany. And my view is that they're going to make a play, assuming that they don't bomb in the group stage of Champions League, for... My guess is their first choice will be Kalidou Koulibaly at Napoli, who does want to leave. And now his road to Manchester City is blocked off because they acquired a Ruben Dias, who looks so far to be pretty good, or Jose Maria Jimenez. But how many players is Atletico Madrid really willing to lose? So there are many young defenders who could help. Look at, like, there are probably 20 French defenders somewhere, but they're all in their late teens and early 20s, and to step in under this bright spotlight, they're years away from being the type of world-class performer that is needed right now. So Koulibaly, and the price, obviously, for a team like Napoli, you know, like many who are looking for money, just went up because of the demand. Now, as for Liverpool's chances in the Premier League, you had postulated at the season's outset that Man City would win the league even with a healthy Liverpool, and I had said Liverpool until someone knocks them off. So it's hard to say that a club all of a sudden loses its mojo when it loses one player, but this is the best defensive player in the world. What I think will happen is that they're going to patch together a strategy, Rusty, that gets them through to January, that they remain in the hunt for the top and be in the top four in the Premier League by New Year's, get through their group stage in the Champions League. Maybe they'll win it, maybe they won't. But they'll patch something together. Now, it's a big jumble at the top of the Premier League. We haven't had that many games played yet, but there's a lot of quality in the Premier League, and there are no real guaranteed Ws on the schedule anymore. As for the Premier League, there's no clear favorite right now. It's hard to see Everton, Aston Villa, who are first and second right now, finishing in the top four. This could be 2015 all over again. Down year for the Big Six.
Yeah, you never know.
And but if that were to happen and someone other than a Big Six club were to win it, it just goes to prove that the 100-year flood could happen twice in 5 years.
That's true. And with all the spending going on that the big teams have done, it wasn't like that before Leicester won, the summer before Leicester won the league. But this year, there's been so much.
And it's hard to know how far they're going to go in the Champions League. That's, you know, there's such quality and such intensity that when Atletico knocked them off last year, you and I both felt that Atletico, with its hamburger grinder defense, could have gone all the way to the finals, and they lost in the next round. People will get up for Liverpool. They make good decisions when it comes to the transfer market. I think reports of their demise are greatly exaggerated. And my hunch is Kalidou Koulibaly, but it depends on the valuations, because Michael Edwards is known and John Henry not to overpay. So enough about Liverpool. All hail Liverpool, because it is a wonderful franchise. But Rusty, there was so much action this week. What struck you the most?
There really was a lot. A lot of dropped points from big teams, too. So teams that drew were Chelsea, Everton, Liverpool, Spurs, and Juventus. And then big teams who lost were Real Madrid, Barcelona, which we'll get to later. Atalanta, who Rich predicted to beat Napoli 4-1. They lost by the same scoreline. There you go. Milan lost in the...
So I can't claim that I made a mistake in the tweet. Did I transpose the score?
I mean, sure, typo or whatever. Who knows?
Boy, was I wrong.
Hey, I mean, it happens. Napoli's a good team. Atalanta play risky, so no shame, no shame. And then also Inter Milan lost to AC Milan in the Derby della Madonnina. So to the Premier League, you know, we're not gonna take you through all the details of every game, but Everton Liverpool, we talked about the pole axing of Virgil van Dijk by Jordan Pickford wasn't great. Sadio Mane could have had a winner, but how much was he offsides by? A big toe, maybe?
It was amazing, and we had predicted a 3-2 Liverpool win at Goodison Park, and you can't get mad at the VAR officials. The rule probably has to change. VAR is shorthand for they are charged with calling offsides if even like a sliver of a fabric is offside, and I think the fans and the players and even the referees are tired of it. But tough one for Everton, for Liverpool, losing Van Dijk, and then when they had that goal, which they thought was the winner, it got disallowed. So tough day.
Yeah, for sure. Moving on, Chelsea 3, Southampton 3. $300 million spent by Chelsea over the summer, and they still can't defend. But one thing that's encouraging for them is Timo Werner had a masterclass, two beautiful goals and one assist that led to a teammate's tap-in. Got some good spacing behind the Southampton defensive line. They do play a very high line, Ralf Hasenhüttl. So it was good to see Timo Werner get some goals. Still more problems with the back for Chelsea. Kurt Zouma and Kepa combined for a gaffe that led to Southampton's second goal. This week's center back combination was Kurt Zouma and Andreas Christensen. That's something that seems to change every week. Theo Walcott returned to Southampton over the summer and celebrated his homecoming in style. It was his first match at back at Southampton, where he got his start. His first start there in 14 years, his first ever Premier League appearance for Southampton, and he scored the equalizer in stoppage time. And basically, Chelsea games this season are going to be entertaining, great for the neutrals, not too great if you are a Chelsea fan, because it could lead to games like
that. Might not help them for goal differential, because they're going to give up goals at the back. Kepa doing Kepa things, Zouma being inconsistent. And before we get to the next match, Rusty, did Theo Walcott get any consideration for the Petit Man Bun Player of the Week?
Yes, he did for the Petit Award. I think we should maybe just shorthand it as Petit Award, because brevity, for the sake of brevity. But yeah, he did get consideration, but I will reveal the winner in due time.
Okay, fair enough. But you can go home again. And Southampton, of course, that great factory for turning out players for the bigger clubs. So what happened at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? Because that was just a confounding match.
A 3-3 draw with West Ham, and it was not that even for most of the game. Spurs were very Spursy. They were winning 3-0 after 82 minutes, and then they gave up three goals. Keep in mind, this is 1 week after they limited the likes of Bruno Fernandes, Paul Pogba, and Marcus Rashford to just one goal in the 6-1 crushing of Manchester United. Spurs had their chances to make it 4-0 before the 80th minute. Harry Kane hit a shot right at Lucas Fabianski in the 60th minute while ignoring a great run from Juan Minson that would have led to a goal. Kane also hit the post 10 minutes later. I think that Kane ignoring Son might have been payback for Son never looking up to pass, but that's neither here nor there. And, I mean, Spurs didn't really look like 90s AC Milan for the first 80 minutes. West Ham certainly had their chances, and the game was wide open, so Spurs really need to tighten up the defense if they want to crack the top four, because it's not doing justice to the great play of Heung-min Son and Harry Kane.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, at the 82nd minute, you know, there was a goal, and then Davinson Sanchez proving again that there aren't such great center backs on that club either, with an own goal that made it 3-2. Where had he ignored it, it might have gone to an attacking player for West Ham and been put in the goal. But he really just blew the clearance. And Aaron Cresswell, the left back for West Ham, was instrumental in some great crosses during those last 10 minutes. And then at the end of stoppage time, at the very end of the match. I mean, there were, what, 5 minutes of stoppage time and 4 minutes and 36 seconds into it. You tell us what happened, because just it defies explanation.
Ball bounces to the edge of the box. Substitute Manuel Lanzini gets on the ball, smashes it, and just curls like a knuckleball into the back of the net. 3-3 draw. West Ham get the point.
You know, that shot was so amazing that Wilt Chamberlain, at the height of his jumping powers, probably in the 1950s, at 7'1", had he leapt, couldn't have touched that. I mean, he hit the ball with his outside of his foot, and it curled in like a banana right under where the top bar and the post meet. I mean, it couldn't have been, and it hit it so hard, it zoomed right back out. Dugout David Moyes, the manager for West Ham, looked like he was a high school kid who just won the lottery or found out he got a car on his 16th birthday. I mean, if you can go on YouTube and watch the highlights, they're worth watching. And, you know, Rusty, we said this before the air. I had thought, you know, watching this match, when they were up 3-0, given what Spurs had done earlier in the season and given that Van Dijk now is out for the season, here's a club that might have it all with the manager, Jose Mourinho, the attack up front, what Gareth Bale might add, to win it all. And then once again, they redefined Spursy, you know, where they just couldn't finish. They just couldn't put it together. And they have so much quality up front with Harry Kane and with Heung-Min Son, who are just really playing great and are some of the best at their position in the world. They're really that good. They might have a little more supply now for Kane, at center attacking midfielder, but they still have some problems to work out at the back. And it was just, you know, a real stunner it felt like a defeat for Spurs when you blow a 3-0 lead after 82 minutes. And it was just a real surprise. So moving on, Rusty, what happened at the Etihad on Saturday?
So the master did beat the apprentice. Pep Guardiola beat Mikel Arteta's Arsenal 1-0, but honestly, I'm starting to get a little bit worried about this Manchester City team. Pep is starting to resemble Louis van Gaal a little bit, and I'm not talking about the mid-1990s Ajax teams of Louis van Gaal. I'm talking about more along the lines of 2010's Manchester United Louis van Gaal, which is not great. There's a lot of side-to-side passing, not very incisive, not nearly as intricate as the world-class Pep teams at Barcelona would play. It's not really rapid from your own touchline to the goal. It's more settling in the other team's area and just passing it around. I mean, Arsenal, they still need to figure it out on offense. They're in the bottom half of clubs in the Premier League in terms of goals scored. Aubameyang has hardly gotten a look on goal, and that's reflected in his expected goals. But the team's defense is looking a lot better. Oddly enough, they have the second best defense in the league. They also had more shots than Manchester City in the match. I thought Bukayo Saka played brilliantly as a midfielder. And according to Football Reference, he had 5 of the team's 16 shot-creating actions, which is pretty big. That's considerable.
So, yeah, I think he's an attacking midfielder. I think he could be the center attacking midfielder. That's the hole for Arsenal. Willian just looked lost out there. I'm not so sure Ceballos can do it. But the key will be also who gets paired with Thomas Partey. And I think that Arteta will pair Granit Xhaka with him as the starter. And the reason is it'll enable Xhaka to go further forward. And Xhaka is a good passer and a good threader of the ball. We've seen it before. But clearly, getting that defensive spine, Rusty, intact is a good thing for clubs, because there are a lot of goals being scored. And I think at the end of the season, the teams with the best defensive discipline will prevail because they'll frustrate the good offensive teams, create opportunities on the counterattack. And it's something that when when we have more matches under our belts, we might see more of. And finally, at St. James Park, Man United Newcastle. That was another odd one, too, in terms of the score. Ended up being 4-1, but it really was close for a while. So what happened up in Newcastle?
Yeah, some interesting personnel moves from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. There's no Anthony Martial or Mason Greenwood available for United. Paul Pogba was on the bench, and the starting lineup was Dan James and Juan Mata flanking Bruno Fernandes in attacking midfield, with Fred and Scott McTominay in holding midfield behind them. So Newcastle scored after 2 minutes thanks to an lucky or unlucky, depending on which side you're on, deflection off of Luke Shaw. Then 23 minutes into the match, Manchester United equalized on a powerful header by Harry Maguire on a corner kick, and the game stayed that way until the 85th minute. But then, a deft pass inside the box from striker Marcus Rashford to Bruno made it 2-1 for Manchester United. And then, in the 90th minute, Aaron Wan-Bissaka waltzed into the box on a late run and scored his first goal for Manchester United in 50 matches played. And I'm really happy for him because I see on Twitter a lot of Manchester United fans giving him stick for not being that good attacking. But his role totally changed moving from Crystal Palace to Manchester United. He has to go further forward now, so it's a completely different position almost for him. And then at the very end of stoppage time, a nice long ball to Marcus Rashford and a great finish from the MBE made it 4-1 to Manchester United, who recovered after such a disappointing result at the hands of Tottenham.
And liberating Ole Gunnar Solskjaer from first place in the first manager to get sacked, possibly sweepstakes too, because had they lost up at St. James Park, we might have to have eliminated that feature, because my guess is he might have been given that Maurizio Pochettino is available, though Poch is said to really love London. So one quick one, Rusty, for you before we take a break. Leicester City hosted Aston Villa. Dean Smith's club went into the Midlands and won 1-0. They are undefeated and undrawn in four matches, and the question for that much was, did Chelsea let the wrong guy go again?
I mean, perhaps. Ross Barkley scored a 90th minute winner in that one after Chelsea sold him to Villa this summer. But I really like this Aston Villa squad. They have made some really smart additions, and players are stepping up, especially John McGinn. They brought in Barkley. They also brought in Ollie Watkins, a striker from Brentford, and Matty Cash, who's a right back. Their defense is stepping up. They've only allowed 2 goals this season. That's the best tally in the league, which is pretty crazy. And Tyrone Mings and Ezri Konsa have improved, and the addition of Emi Martinez has been great. So it's kind of a backwards year as in football as in real life, with Arsenal and Aston Villa so far having the best defensive records in the league.
And last year, all they talked about was how bad Arsenal's defense was. And with that, we've covered the Premier League. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the other leagues in Europe and our feature awards. This is Unexpected Goals on 860 AM WWDB.
At any given moment, somewhere in America, a baby is taking a first step, a developmental milestone. But for too many parents, a baby's first steps aren't just a milestone. They're a miracle. These are the parents of babies who were born prematurely or with birth defects. It's a crisis affecting more than 500,000 babies in the United States each year. You can help them by joining volunteers like you who walk in March for Babies. The money you raise funds research and local programs that help babies overcome the challenges of premature birth and birth defects. Together, our steps make stronger, healthier babies a reality for thousands of families. Sign up today at marchforbabies.org to take the steps that help make milestones and even miracles possible. Who will you march for?
We're back at the WWDB AM Talk 860 studios with Unexpected Goals, Rich and Rusty. And Rusty, now it's time for our features. And it is the Petit Award. Now, it's not a little award. It is the Petit Award named after Arsenal midfielder Emmanuel Petit. And it is the Man Bun Player of the Week. And this is much awaited because we know that it's not going to be Theo Walcott, whose man bun looked pretty spectacular, by the way. And it can't be Gareth.
Fine form.
Right. And it can't be Gareth Bale because he didn't really do anything. So who wins the Petit Award for this week?
Well, it was a tough week this week. There are some great performances. You mentioned Walcott. There's also Dominic Calvert-Lewin, who scored the equalizer in the Merseyside Derby. He's already won the award twice, so he was going for a hat trick this week. But the winner is RB Leipzig striker Yusuf Poulsen. He came off the bench in the 66th minute in a 1-0 game away to Augsburg, and with his first touch of the match, scored an insane left-footed volley from just inside the left side of the box. As I said, first touch of the match, makes it 2-0 and takes RB Leipzig to the top of the Bundesliga table. So he is the winner of the Petit Award, the third winner in 4 weeks, I believe. So congrats to him. Now moving on to our other weekly award, as we alluded to earlier, one of our popular segments, the first manager to get sacked in the English Premier League sweepstakes. Rich, who's leading the pack right now?
Wow. It is hard to say, for sure. Going into the weekend, the leader was Manchester United's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but United, as we said, went to Newcastle, played against the club coached by a Man U alum, Steve Bruce, and won 4-1. It was convincing enough. Is it redemption for Ole? Hardly. And it's probably not, you know, he's probably not a world-class manager on his best days, and he's far from a horrible one in his awful days. And as I said before, I think that if United had played poorly up at St. James Park, Ed Woodward, the managing director of Man U, would have ordered a car service for Maurizio Pochettino. So that said, I think we can narrow the field a bit. Ole is a room reserved at the inn on the list just because he's at Man U and because he is not regarded with reverence and doesn't have a long-term deal. Others in the running are Steve Bruce at Newcastle because ownership is unstable, and Roy Hodgson, both of whose clubs are mid-table now, but both of whose clubs could slip mightily. And I would also add the coaches in the bottom three, Slaven Bilic at West Brom, Scott Parker at Fulham, and Sean Dyche at Burnley. And then for right now, I would say that Sean Dyche has the lead because of his general unhappiness at small, under-resourced Burnley. He's done a masterful job at the club. It's the smallest city in the Premier League. But how long can he do it, or does he want to do it? And the better question right now, Rusty, might be, who is the early candidate for manager of the year in the Premier League? And the two teams at the top, Everton and Aston Villa, you could say Carlo Ancelotti, who's been manager of the year elsewhere, and Dean Smith, whose team almost got relegated last season. So Sean Dyche, I would think, don't renew your lease up in Northwest England. And now, Rusty, we're inaugurating a new feature, the soccer tweet of the weekend, because there's always good banter if you follow as many folks as we do. So do you want to go through the nominees? Why don't you go through the nominees?
Sure. I'll go through the nominees. A guy named Ed, last name I can't pronounce, he had a brilliant reply to a tweet from The Athletic's Tom Werville. Werville's tweet said the following: Sons had 11 shots this season, and lists what they all resulted in. Most of them resulted in goals, and then the last two resulted in saves. And the finalist, this guy Ed, had a masterful reply saying, "You must be a proud dad." Because Wenmin Son.
Right. That was a good one. That one got a lot of coverage.
And then Ben Dolman, a Spurs fan, who tweeted, "We bring on Bale, West Ham bring on Lanzini," followed by four crying laughing emojis. And you know the rest of the story. That prompted a response from none other than West Ham holding midfielder Declan Rice saying, "This aged well," followed by a snarky-faced emoji and a shiny gem emoji. And finally, on Twitter, we saw Jose Mourinho's comments about Arsene Wenger's book, where Mourinho said it was understandable that Wenger did not mention Mourinho in his book because Wenger never beat him. And when you write a book, you only want to write about happy things, to which Wenger replied with him, "It's a constant provocation. I feel like I am at kindergarten, but that is part of his personality."
So who wins?
Tough week. But I think just for the classic, the classicness of his tweet, Ed has to win for "You must be a proud dad" about Tom Werville and Wenmin Son's shots on goal.
Yes, Tom Werville, by the way, the analytics soccer writer for The Athletic, who just joined and who has made good contributions there. The Spurs fans' tweet got hundreds of thousands of likes, or at least Declan Rice's. And there's another good one that was on Twitter. It was Spurs fans watching the match and being elated, and then seeing goal after goal scored and just sinking in misery, followed by the the theme music to Curb Your Enthusiasm, as if the Spurs fans found themselves at a Larry David predicament, which they did. So from that, Russ, I'm going to just move on to games of the week to tell folks that our game of the week tomorrow, more Champions League group stage, Ajax hosts Liverpool. We're going to see how good this Ajax team is, and they are good. And Liverpool without Virgil van Dijk, match number one. Thursday, Europa League group stage, Rapid Vienna in Vienna hosts Arsenal. And we'll see if Arsenal can solve for its offensive woes. Friday, Aston Villa hosts Leeds United. The bloom is off the roads a bit for Leeds United. And we'll see if Aston Villa can sustain its unbeaten streak. Saturday has two matches you must watch in the city of brotherly love. First, El Clasico. Barcelona hosts Real Madrid. And then for a doubleheader, so it's three matches, Man U hosts Chelsea after El Clasico ends. So, you know, just ordering food and maybe use Uber Eats because they're the jersey sponsor for Marseille. And then our own Philadelphia Union in second place in the East in MLS hosts first place Toronto, and Philadelphia fans all over the Twitter sphere are saying that this might be the most important match in club history, and you can watch it. There's probably a limited number of tickets, and some might be available down at the park, but clearly Jim Curtin has this club headed in the right direction. And Sunday, Southampton with Ralf Hasenhüttl on the touchline against just on fire Everton, and those are a good complement of matches.
And speaking of birthdays, by the way, of the Union, Ernst Tanner's birthday was yesterday. So hopefully the Union can give him a nice present on Saturday with 3 points against Toronto.
Well, Russ, speaking of that, too, and we might as well touch upon this now, there was a birthday present of sorts in MLS this week with the news that Brendan Aaronson, the center attacking midfielder and an early guest on our show when we first went on the air in January, one of the best prospects in the league, agreed to a transfer to RB Salzburg. And the transfer fee for the Union is roughly $6 million, as reported by friend of the show Jonathan Tannenwald of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Russ, why don't we go through this? What's the significance of this transfer? I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's the biggest transfer for an American player from MLS ever. The second highest fee ever for a homegrown MLS player, next to the $13 million spent by Bayern Munich for Alphonso Davies. You could say that worked out pretty well.
Hopefully this one will too, yeah.
Hoping this one will too, but I think it's a great moment for MLS. I mean, we've seen lots of players develop in Europe who then came back to play for the U.S. national team. But I think the fact that we're seeing more players getting their start in MLS and being able to build up their skills there to be able to play for teams that are routinely in the Champions League, that's something special for me. So I think MLS is working its way to become a real feeder league. And I think this is the prime example of what they're going to try to do. And I mean, for the Union, it also looks great because Anthony Fontana is stepping up right as Brendan Aaronson is on his way out. So it's really good. I think if you can get it right, it's a really good way of doing business for these MLS teams. And I hope that most of the teams in the league follow suit for the Union, because then the U.S. national team would be a lot better.
Yeah, this also seems to be the proof of concept, as you said, for Philadelphia Union owner Jay Sugarman and director of football Ernst Tanner and head coach Jim Curtin. When we had Jim Curtin on our show, our first ever one in January, he indicated that becoming a team that sent players to the highest level was one of the club's goals. And now if you're a young player in the U.S., why wouldn't you want to come to the Union and its academy? Because all the pieces seem to be in place. And not only is it important that Brendan Aaronson is going to RB Salzburg, where he'll have to adjust to some colder weather, and also the fact that soccer will be on the front pages and much more talked about where he's going than, say, here. And it's an adjustment anywhere. But the fact that Fontana just steps in is pretty amazing. He's looked terrific for the Union lately. You know, good stuff from you, Rusty, you know, because you're the one of the two of us who really follows MLS, and there are more than I do, and there just are a lot more players coming through the pipeline. And 2020, for all of its problems, a watershed year. American soccer players in terms of they're really emerging on the world stage with Sergiño Dest at Barcelona, Weston McKennie at Juventus, and of course Christian Pulisic, who really just surged after the pandemic-induced break to become a real star for a top-drawer club in Chelsea. So with that, Rusty, the rest of Europe in maybe 10 minutes. So here we go. The Bundesliga. Okay. They'll say the defense at Bayern Munich is a concern. They've given up 8 goals in 4 matches and most goals of the top 14 clubs in the league. They also have scored 17 goals in the run-and-gun league, and that is 7 more than the next club, RB Leipzig. Their fullbacks come very far forward. They have a lot of center backs, among them Nicolas Soule, Jerome Boateng, David Alaba, who is once one of the best fullbacks in the world. There is not a logical starting spot for Lucas Hernandez, for whom they paid a very significant sum. They also have the young American Chris Richards, who's gotten a look. What do you think? I think this situation will sort itself out through competition and practice, and there's so much supply that it's hard to imagine that Hansi Flick will not figure it out and get it all sorted out within the next month. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. They just have so much talent. It's crazy. But, I think that maybe they're a little bit rusty, pardon the pun, not intentional. I think that they're still bouncing back from the weird schedule that has been this year. They also might be a little bit tired. They do have the depth to rotate, so I hope they take advantage of that. They have, especially playing at the very tail end of the international break when they had a DFB Pokal game. So I think they're going to need to do a lot of rotation, but they do have the skill. So I think by December, they should be good.
I think they will be too. The top four in the Bundesliga, RB Leipzig, coached by that wunderkind Julian Nagelsmann, who's all of 33, is in first, followed by Bayern Munich, then Borussia Dortmund with its great attack, featuring American Gio Reyna and also the next great striker up, Erling Haaland, and of course the wonderful winger, the English Jadon Sancho, and then Eintracht Frankfurt is fourth. The biggest story is the fifth place club, Stuttgart, just promoted. Pellegrino Matarazzo, the Columbia University alum, he's their manager. And after 4 matches, they're 2 wins, 1 loss, 1 draw. So going to La Liga, the last time Barcelona and Real Madrid lost on the same day was when?
I have no idea.
It actually wasn't that long ago. It was in September of 2018.
There you go.
And both have Champions League group stage matches this week, and then El Clasico at Camp Nou on Saturday. Both teams need to make a statement, show better form. It'll be compelling watching, and it's kind of too early to tell. But is there redemption, Rusty, for Unai Emery at Villarreal? They are in second place behind Real Sociedad. What's going on in the middle of the country?
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing well. They have 8 goals scored, and they've given up 8 in 6 matches. So it's kind of hard to get a totally good read on them just yet. But they beat their rivals Valencia 2-1 at home this weekend on goals by former Valencia captain Dani Parejo. And I believe former Valencia striker Paco Alcácer. But as I said, this Villarreal club has suffered a huge fire sale.
Valencia, yeah, it was Valencia. Valencia suffered the fire sale, right.
The two are easy to get confused, but there's still a lot of football left to be played and to see whether you and I can keep this going for the whole season.
Yeah, I mean, a good start for sure. Always good to be at the top of the table. This Real Sociedad team could be pretty good. They slammed Real Betis in Seville this weekend 3-0. David Silva, the all-time great for Man City, anchors the middle, and they have a young star in Mikel Oyarzabal, who's playing up on the right wing.
Nice pronunciation.
Hey, there you go. I mean, those Z's is the THs because some old king apparently did have a speech impediment way back in the day. That's what we were told when we were in Spain, and even though their manager is doing a wonderful job in his second stint at the club, they also have playing a fullback, former Arsenal mainstay Nacho Monreal. The top four, Real Sociedad, the class of the league, Villarreal, Real Madrid, and Getafe, who beat Barcelona 1-0 this weekend. Barca's in ninth. And to show how wacky this league is so far, after five matches, Atletico Madrid has yielded one goal and is in eighth place, while Villarreal is in second, having scored and given up eight goals. And Granada and Real Betis in sixth and seventh have negative goal differentials. So with that, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we have Ligue 1 and we have Serie A. We also have Alex. What difference Alex Morgan could or could not make with Tottenham Hotspur's women's team and the Golden Boy Awards. This is Unexpected Goals on WWDB AM 860.
Women Heart is in a race to save lives. Heart disease is the number one killer of women. It's 80% preventable, if you know the facts. Millions of women are living with or at risk of different types of heart disease, like AFib, which is a type of irregular heartbeat. It affects both women and men, but women with AFib have a higher risk of stroke and death than men. Get educated. See your doctor. Know the facts. Diet and exercise are key to staying healthy. Know the risks. Women Heart does something really unique, solely focusing on women and providing peer-to-peer support. To win this race, we all have to do it together. Our hearts beat as one. To learn more, visit womenheart.org.
We are back live in Philadelphia in the WWDB 860 AM studios with Unexpected Goals, Rusty and Rich. And Rust, now, as we promised, turning to Ligue 1, the French league. What is going on there? What are some of the highlights? Can anybody ultimately defeat PSG? And is there another team or two that might have a good story to tell this season? What do we see so far?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of goals so far. I mean, the only teams who have yielded less than 10 goals are PSG, Lille, and Bordeaux. PSG are still looking iffy at midfield and making their way to the top of the table. But after a slow start, they have amassed 16 goals and only yielded three after seven matches. Lille's sporting director just resigned and could command big bucks elsewhere because he's very good at his job. And top four right now are Lille, PSG, Rennes, and Nice. Nice are a very good young team, and so are Rennes. Rennes have Eduardo Camavinga, who is one of, if not the best young player in the world. We will discuss that later with the Golden Boy Award. But yeah, I mean, as we've said before, it is an entertaining league to watch, especially if you want to get a look at the next prospects up. And, you know, lots of goals. Can't complain with that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are a lot of good prospects. As we said last week, the average age of players in that league is a couple years younger than the Premier League. And my guess is also some of the other leagues in Europe. It's a pretty young league. And then moving on to Serie A, the top four, Milan, undefeated and undrawn, is first, followed by surprising Sassuolo, which is from the north central part of the country, also undefeated with one draw. And then Atalanta and Napoli. Juventus is in fifth. Inter Milan is sixth, and all of these clubs only have played four matches apiece because the league got started later. Milan has scored nine goals in four matches while only yielding one, whereas in contrast...
Shout out to Zlatan.
Exactly. Zlatan Ibrahimovic still going, the Methuselah of modern football. And then Atalanta, in contrast to Milan, has scored 14 goals in four matches but also has yielded nine. There could be a mad scramble for the top four and the top of the league, and as we have said all along, this will be the most competitive league outside the Premier League. And, you know, Rusty, what's so new at Milan? We've kind of dissed them during the year because even Gazidis, the former head of Arsenal, moved over there. It could well have been that it was the Krenkes and not Gazidis holding Gazidis back. But what's new that Milan all of a sudden is so hot?
Well, what's not new is they're still very young and outstanding goalkeeper Gianluigi Donnarumma. It seems like he's been their goalie for like half a decade, and I think he's still 21 years old, which is nuts. Stefano Pioli, their manager, is doing a great job. That's the reason why they decided not to hire Ralph Ragnick over the summer. They stole young defensive midfielder Sandro Tonali, who has drawn comparisons to both both Andrea Pirlo and Gennaro Gattuso as a hybrid of them, got him for a bargain price from Brescia, and he is still struggling to get into the team because that's how well they're playing. He didn't see action until the 87th minute in the derby. They beat Inter 2-1 in the derby this weekend. And what is new is both new and old, because Zlatan Ibrahimovic is 38. He just returned to the team in the middle of last season from the LA Galaxy, but he's already been with the team before. He scored 2 goals in the first half to give his team the win. Backline has been solid with Calabria, Cher, Alessio Romagnoli, and Teo Hernandez, which is the brother of Lucas Hernandez of Bayern Munich. Hakan Çalhanoğlu has really stepped up this year. It's been a great year for AC Milan.
No, they were really off to a good start, and 3 points is as important in the September and October timeframe as it, of course, it becomes in April and May. Sassuolo, 41-year-old manager Roberto De Cherby, this is his third season with the club and his 8th year as a manager. Sassuolo is his 5th club, which is not all that unusual for younger managers. They were down 3-1 at Bologna over the weekend after 60 minutes and rallied to score 3 goals between the 64th and 77th minutes to nail down the victory. 3 players have combined for 9 goals after 4 matches. Francesco Caputo, their striker, Domenico Berardi, a central attacking midfielder, and Filip Dirčić, the former FIFA favorite. When he was young years ago, he always projected out in manager mode to be a huge star. 28-year-old, he's actually a Dutch national, and he scored a goal this weekend. And one of their defenders...
Berardi's a good player, too.
Yes, definitely. And one of their defenders is the former Romanian wunderkind, Vlad Cherecis, who was supposed to be a defensive star at Tottenham years ago, back in the day when they acquired him. And he's found a home in the Modena province in Italy. And one match that is worth noting this weekend, Getafe, which is one of the 4 clubs, one of the 3 in La Liga that's in the Madrid area next to the 2 big ones. They're in a suburb. They beat Barcelona 1-0 this weekend. Rust, why don't you tell us a little bit about that match and what we all can learn from it?
Well, Getafe are notoriously hard to play against. After the match, Barca manager Ronald Koeman complained that right midfielder Alan Neon had some unkind words for the coach. Former Barcelona left back Marc Cucurella, a product of their La Masia Academy, he never broke into Barca's first team, but he started at left midfield for Getafe. Both he and Alan Niam are former fullbacks who played on the wings for Getafe, if that gives you any sense of their style. They're based in southern Madrid, and they are, to put it nicely, hard-nosed. They gave no space to Barca. They play a lot like Atletico Madrid and get away with lots of little tricks. They're a bit handsy. They'll grab you and hit you when the ref isn't looking. They get away with a lot. And they played some decent counterattacks. Also, they have one of the most underrated players in Spanish football, Jaime Mata, not Juan Mata. Jaime Mata is their striker. He scored the penalty in the 1-0 win for Getafe. And yeah, they're a tough team. I don't know if they have the offense to be able to win or to make a run into the Champions League, but they do cause problems for the very best teams in the world.
Tell us about Barca's lineup. There's been a lot of talk about it. They have some aging players in there. How did it look?
Well, the big news for Americans especially is that Sergiño Dest got his first start for FC Barcelona, and he played left back. Also starting were the 17-year-old Pedri, who's an attacking midfielder, and Ousmane Dembele started at left wing and made his first start in almost a year because of injuries. I mean, Dest wasn't anything special defensively. He did lead Barcelona in key passes with a whopping 2, which kind of tells you how that game went. But that's a good sign for him. He certainly held his own and didn't look out of place. Ousmane Dembele did look pretty rusty. He did look like he had been out of action for almost a year. Had some decent moves with the ball, but was just lacking the sort of sharpness and communication with his teammates. All of Barcelona's attackers looked out of sync for the majority of the match. Pedri had a couple nice moves, so I'll give credit to him, but yeah, Barcelona really struggled to break down this Getafe team.
Well, I think too, what we're seeing right now is to use for older fans an analogy to a boxing match. The clubs are all feeling each other out, trying to figure out how to attack. You see these disparities. You know, you see poor. They didn't really have a lot of time off to rest and to regroup and to implement and to teach and coach and implement new strategies. And what I think most managers would say is that a lot of the development can come in the off season. They give players probably take some time off, but work on these things with trainers or individually, take a break, but get at it. And then they sit down and they really look at their strengths and weaknesses. And then from the get-go, they try to adapt. So in Arsenal's case, it's been a problem on offense. There's a lot of supply there, it's coordinating it, but in many teams it's just getting that defensive spine. Efan Okoku, who was on the show, who comments for NBC Sports, their football coverage, predicted that, and it's held true. And you know, that's why there's, to use another analogy, there's a big peloton, as they say in the Tour de France, of the group of bikers that follow the leader, except for the fact that there are no real leaders right now. And, you know, we will see going forward who emerges and who doesn't. It'll be a factor of depth. It'll be a factor of health. And it'll be a factor of which managers can emerge and where leaders might emerge on teams. So, you know, it's too easy to count out some of the stalwarts to say that give up on Liverpool because Van Dijk's out. You know that Jurgen Klopp won't let the club use that as an excuse to lose, but sometimes you can give a team an excuse to lose. Dallas Cowboys, oh, we can't win without Dak, to use an American football analogy, and they certainly look like they couldn't, you know, last night. But going back, it's probably our only American football reference we'll make on this show. And
Eagles.
Right. It's been compelling watching, to tell you the truth, to watch all these matches and these new players to develop. So, Rusty, now speaking of young players, and this is always fun to talk about what the future might bear, FIFA announced last week the 20 nominees for the Golden Boy Award for the best player under the age of 21. And why don't we talk about your rankings of the nominees? And you know, why don't you go through them? And it looks like in our joint outline for the show, you readjusted them to rank them, whereas I just threw them out there. Or no, you didn't.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, you did. Okay.
To rank them, I wanted to give it a little bit of flavor. I won't start from the bottom because that's doing too much. My winner for the award is Erling Haaland. I mean, he has been, I think, of this list by far the best player. And even though his team didn't win any silverware, he has done so much in the past year and scored so many goals and has had so many great moments that I think he deserves to win this award. Number two, someone who did win silverware and was pretty instrumental in his team's success, I'd say, is Alphonso Davies. I think that he didn't have the superstar impact that Erling Haaland did for Borussia Dortmund, but he did play a key role on that Bayern Munich team that was wildly successful. And then I'll go a little shorter on each of the ones here on out, but number three is Jadon Sancho, great player. Four is Eduardo Camavinga. Five is Ansu Fati.
Let's just say Camavinga is at Rennes, which is really doing some good things right now in Ligue 1, and Ansu Fati at Barcelona. I just want to interject on Jadon Sancho. I had him at the top of my list with all his goals and assists for Borussia Dortmund, and I do worry that the dominance of those two players at the top, or their presence at the top, Haaland and Sancho, they might split a vote, so to speak, and you could see Davies emerge as the winner.
Just like Darius Saric and Joel Embiid did in the Rookie of the Year,
there's our Philadelphia connection. And now, of course, we might be saying Dario who. So you have Fati is fifth. Why don't we? And these are some wonderful names, so it's okay to spend a little more time in our remaining minutes of the show. But why don't we run through actually, you know, pretty quickly the rest of them? There are a lot of good ones.
Yeah. So the next three, I have Mason Greenwood at sixth because the next three are all Englishmen. Mason Greenwood of United is the leader of this particular group, just because I thought he had the most impact for his team. Then it's Bukayo Saka, who had quite a few assists for Arsenal over the past year. Then it's Phil Foden, who, you know, is a personal favorite of mine.
Phil Foden, it took 54 minutes to mention Phil this week. Wow, that's a record.
Yeah, I know, crazy. But I think this coming year, if he's still of age for the award, he could win it because he'll get more playing time. I think that's similar with Bukayo Saka and Ansu Fati. After Foden, I have Vinicius Jr. of Real Madrid, also a great player. But
not to be confused with Carlos Vinicius, the striker that Tottenham signed to back up Larry Kane. Harry Kane.
Not to be confused. So I think once he can lead Real Madrid some silverware, he'll get more recognition. Then I have Ferran Torres, who just moved to Manchester City. After him, Sandro Tonali, another player with potential to move up on this list in the years to come because he's still young. After Tonali, I have Rodrigo Goes from Real Madrid, another Brazilian winger. Again, the type of player who can move up on this list. After him is Dejan Kulusevski of Juventus. I admit I didn't see him play too much for Udinese before he moved to Juve. And then after him is Mitchell Bakker, then Callum Hudson-Odoi, then Dominic Szoboszlai, Serginho Dest, Jonathan David, Fabio Silva, and Ryan Gravenberch.
Yeah, and remember the name Szoboszlai from RB Salzburg, a central attacking midfielder who will be in the pipeline to a bigger club, and some of the biggest clubs are already interested in him. And Mitchell Bakker getting some good reviews also, as they do need fullbacks in Paris. So, Rusty, in 20 seconds or 30 seconds, Arsenal's women played Tottenham Hotspur. Alex Morgan didn't get in there. What was the score and what were one or two highlights? And it's clear from the score, Alex Morgan won't make that much of a difference when she gets there.
Yeah, 6-1 Arsenal win. Vivian Miedema scored a hat trick and became the leading scorer all time in the FA Women's Super League with her 52nd goal in her 50th game. And left back Katie McCabe scored a beautiful free kick in the third minute. Arsenal forced Tottenham to make two first half substitutions, and it was a good old-fashioned thrashing.
And with that, boy, we covered it all. Sean Spence behind the glass. This is Unexpected Goals with Rich and Rusty on WWDB AM 860. Have a great day.